What of the man's wife and his bodyguards? Damn it, Renee. The marimba tone went silent. Renee's phone went to voicemail. At the beep, Jack cupped his hand over the microphone and whispered, Renee, call me back. We've got activity at Coricepa Lodge. We could use your help. Jack disconnected and set the phone ringer to vibrate only mode. Jack doubted he'd get a return call, but if Renee had been worrying about Jack pursuing him to Zurich, perhaps Jack's message had bought him a slight tactical advantage. The problem was that the home's vast windows and darkened interior made any approach route dangerous. Would Renee open fire on him? Jack wondered. From the house came a woman's scream, then a lone gunshot. No choice now. Jack stepped out of the trees, raised the HK, and sprinted across the lawn to the house's nearest wall, which he followed to a sliding glass door. Through it he could see a kitchen and dining alcove. The decor was modern industrial, hard angles, straight lines, and brushed stainless steel. A body lay on the polished concrete floor. It was a man in a suit. Bodyguard, Jack guessed. With his gun trained on the interior, he reached out and tried the door. It was locked. He moved on until he reached the building's next corner, where he found a set of zigzag steps that led him to the second floor wraparound balcony. He stopped on the top step and crouched. Ahead was another wall of glass. On the other side was what looked like a home office. The interior door was open, and through it Jack could see a carpeted hallway lit by a green outlet nightlight. Jack stood up, walked down the balcony until he found the office's heavy exterior glass door. He tried the latch. It was unlocked. He eased open the door. With a soft hiss of hydraulics, the door swung open. Jack stepped through, and as the door hissed shut, paced to the doorway and looked down the hall. There were three doors, two on his right and one at the end of the hall. This one was partially open, and through the gap Jack could see what looked like the moving beam of a flashlight. A woman cried in German, "Hör auf damit, bitte!" Stop that, please. Jack heard the sound of a scuffle, feet shuffling on carpet, followed by a thump and a grunt of pain. "Ihr kann nicht atmen," the woman shouted. "Bitte!" Her voice panicked, partially garbled, but Jack caught two words. "Can't breathe." Jack murmured, "The hell with this." He zipped his anorak all the way up so the cowl was covering the lower half of his face, then stepped out and trotted down the hall. He stopped at the door. Through the gap to his right was a bed. A woman with long gray hair and wearing a nightgown lay face down on the bed. Bossard's wife. Her feet and ankles were duct taped. Her head was facing Jack, but her eyes were fixed on something out of sight. Jack pulled out his phone and again dialed Renee. The marimba ringtone started. Jack eased open the door, raised the HK, and stepped into the bedroom. To his left, Renee, or so Jack assumed, as the figure was wearing a black balaclava, stood before Alexander Bossard, who was bound to a hardback chair. His right eye was swollen shut and blood trickled from his mouth. Renee had his Walther P-22 pressed against Bossard's forehead. Renee dug his phone from his pocket and checked the screen. "Damn it," he muttered. Bossard's wife saw Jack in the doorway. She screamed. Renee glanced in her direction, saw where her eyes were pointed, then started to spin around. Jack was already moving, charging forward. Using the butt of the HK, he backhanded Renee across the temple. He stumbled sideways, then slumped to the carpet, unconscious. Mrs. Bossard was still screaming. Jack pointed his gun at her. "Ruhe," he barked. She went quiet. He added, "Ich werde nicht wehtun. Verstehst du?"
"Ja, ja,"
she replied, nodding emphatically.
"Ich verstehe."
Jack turned to Alexander Bossard. His head was lolling to one side. His eyes were half closed. Jack said, "Keine Sorge. Ich komme wieder." "Don't worry, I'll be back." "Verstehst du?"
"Ja,"
he mumbled. Jack glanced at Mrs. Bossard and got another nod. He reached down, pocketed Renee's gun, then grabbed him by the jacket collar and dragged him out of the room and down the hallway. He removed Renee's balaclava.
"Idiot,"
Jack whispered. The door to Jack's right was a bathroom. He soaked a towel in the sink, then wrung the cold water over Renee's upturned face, before dragging his knuckles over Renee's sternum. Renee's eyes fluttered open. He tried to sit up. Jack pushed him back down and held the HK before his eyes. Understand?
We.
What the hell were you thinking, Renee? Is that man downstairs dead?
No, of course not.
This was very stupid. How did you think this was going to play out?
Bossard would talk, and then we would know.
Know what? Asked Jack.
If you and Ephraim are right about Rostock.
Jack squeezed the bridge of his nose between his index finger and thumb.
I should hand you over to the police.
In fact, that's what I'm going to do. He pulled out his cell phone.
You wouldn't do that, Jack.
I'm doing it right now.
Please don't. Just listen. For a moment.
Jack shrugged his agreement, and Renee said,
I wasn't going to kill him or his wife.
You beat the shit out of him and terrorized his wife.
He deserves it, and worse.
Maybe, Jack replied. But you're not seeing the big picture. Right now, whether we're right about Rostock and about what happened to you isn't the point. Something bad is about to go down in Namibia. We have a chance, or had a chance for all I know, to stop it. Instead, I'm back here. All because you can't keep your shit together and act like the soldier you should be.
Rene didn't reply, but rather squeezed his eyes shut. He lifted his head and banged it against the carpet.
I want this to be over, Jack.
Then go back to France. I went to see your father in Paris. He wants you home. He never gave up on you, and nothing he did led to your kidnapping. It's Rostock, Rene, and you know it. He tortured you, messed with your brain, got you addicted to drugs. He's behind the Lyon attacks and the incidents in India, Canada, and Panama, and maybe others.
Why would he kidnap me?
He asked your father to support his neo-warfare plan, and your father turned him down, as did many others. Rostock reasoned that getting a Marshal of France on his side would be the first domino.
That's delusional, Rene said. He's delusional.
He's made the leap, Jack thought. He said with a smile, takes one to know one. Rene smiled back. Are you still going to call the police? Are you going to stop acting like a dickhead?
Yes.
Then we're good. Jack helped Rene to a sitting position. Rene sighed. He gave himself a slap on the head.
God, what have I done? Idiot!
Is Bossard hurt badly? I'll look him over, but I don't think so. Did you ask him anything?
No, not yet. After I started beating him, I froze. I realized that beyond getting my hands on him, I didn't have a plan.
Did you speak to either of them? Rene nodded. In French or German?
German. Why?
We might be able to turn this to our advantage, Jack replied, then spent the next few minutes explaining what he had in mind.
Is your German good enough to pull it off?
Ja, sicher. Much better than yours.
Good. Follow my lead. Rene got to his feet. Jack grabbed him by the collar and marched him down the hall into the bedroom. Jack positioned him between Bossard and his wife, then cuffed him in the head.
Los!
In German, and with some decent acting skills, Jack saw, Rene apologized to the Bossards. He'd overstepped his authority, had misunderstood his instructions. The people for whom they work want Jürgen Rostock, not Bossard. Millions have been spent, and promises have been broken. They were supposed to get a Mumbai or an Ontario. We know you've been helping him. If you choose to help us instead, you'll come to no harm. If you call the police or Rostock, we will know. We will come back. When Rene finished speaking, Jack jerked him by the collar and shoved him out of the room. Then Jack squared off before Bossard. The man's one undamaged eye was wide open, and he was sitting erect, alert. Their piece of theater had had its desired effect. Bossard would play along, but how thoroughly only time would tell.
At the very least, they had stuck a wedge between Bossard and Rostock. Now, Jack wanted to drive it home. He walked behind Bossard's chair and cut his hands free of the duct tape. Jack said, "Do you speak English?" Bossard rubbed his wrists and stared up warily.
"Yes, I do."
5 years ago, your daughter Suzette was kidnapped in Brazil, correct?
"Yes, what?"
"And Rostock rescued her. Shortly after that, you took RSG on as a client. That was no coincidence. He's done it since. It's a recruiting technique. Verstehst du?"
"Ich verstehe," replied Bossard.
"I understand. But I have trouble believing Jürgen would do such a thing." "Then you haven't looked hard enough. You can believe me or not believe me. It changes nothing. You're either with us or against us. Someone will be in touch. Have your answer ready." Chapter 35. Windhoek, Namibia. Ephraim hadn't answered his phone since René and Jack arrived at the Zurich airport for their return flight. Almost 18 hours and no contact. Jack had a sinking feeling what that meant, and he hoped he was wrong. According to Jack's phone, the GPS tracker on the Pilatus hadn't moved an inch from its spot at Midgard airstrip. If Ephraim had disobeyed Jack's orders and gone to Coracepa Lodge to keep an eye on Muller, his silence might mean nothing. That far outside the city, cell coverage was spotty at best. Or it could mean he'd been caught, and Muller was getting another chance at interrogating Ephraim. As he and René stepped onto the tarmac and headed toward the terminal, Jack dialed Ephraim's phone one more time and again got his voicemail. "You try," Jack told René, who dialed and then disconnected.
"No joy."
Jack's phone beeped. It was a text from Mitch. The timestamp was from 8 hours earlier. "Call me." Jack did. Mitch said immediately, "Klugman moved. He left the Hilton." "How long ago?" "I texted you as soon as it happened. When I didn't hear back, I called Ephraim." "Where's Klugman now?"
"I have no idea."
Jack had a fair idea where, which meant Ephraim did as well. "Mitch, I'm going to text you an email address. If you don't hear from one of us in 5 days, send all the Bossard docs to that address. Can you do that?"
"5 days, no problem. Should I include an explanation or a..."
"No, they'll figure it out. Thanks, see you." Jack disconnected. He recounted his conversation with Mitch to René. "Let's get back to the hotel." The suite was unoccupied, but some of Ephraim's clothes were missing, as were some items from Jack's go bag he'd left behind. Binoculars, digital camera, multi-tool, duct tape, and first aid kit.
"Idiot," Jack said.
"At least I've got company," René replied.
"What do we do?"
"We go after him.
Do you have any idea where we can get some weapons?"
René had no specific ideas, but, he said, having lived and worked in Africa for years, he knew generally where and for whom to look. "Weapons dealers here use a lot of the same survival strategies," he said. "They're often not so frightened by the police, but by rival dealers."
"To cull competition?" Jack asked.
"And to increase their own inventory. Plus, it's a matter of pride. If you're going to be a merchant of death in Africa, you can't be shy about using violence. You must walk the walk."
At least Ephraim hadn't taken the Land Cruiser, Jack thought. With Jack behind the wheel, they toured the city. Though he occasionally glanced at the fold-out map in his lap, René spent most of the time gazing out his window, telling Jack to turn in here, circle back there, pull to this curb or under this tree, where they would watch the people for a while before moving on. At open-air markets and cafes, René would leave Jack behind in the Toyota, then walk around and chat with locals. Though Jack didn't understand what exactly René was seeing or asking, it was clear the soldier was getting a feel for Windhoek's pulse and rhythm.
"Do you think he'll be there?" René asked after a while.
"Who?
Rostock?"
"Yes."
"I doubt it.
Rostock's a general. As much as they may want to, generals know better than to go into the field. Müller is his captain. We'll be dealing with him and however many RSG operatives he brings along. At least 8 that we can count on.
So be it, René murmured, staring out the window.
After another hour of scouting, René declared that Katatura Township Central, the heart of Windhoek's worst slum, was their best chance for finding what they needed. Jack took the Western Bypass Highway north to the edge of the city, where he turned west onto the perhaps sadistically named Independence Avenue, which took them into the slum proper. Everywhere Jack looked, there was nothing but dirt and rolling, rock-strewn hills, all packed tightly with sheds and huts made from a mishmash of materials, from cardboard to aluminum to massive highway signs that had been bent into open lean-to or A-frame shelters. Everywhere, smiling black children ran and played, while women waited in quarter-mile lines at a water pump.
70% of Windhoek lives right here, Jack, said René. About 140,000 people.
Jack had the urge to stop the Land Cruiser, get out, and empty his pockets. But he knew it would likely cause more harm than good. A problem like Katatura wouldn't be changed by simply throwing money at it. Jack didn't know what the larger solution was, but looking at the faces of the kids waving as they passed made his heart ache. After a few brief stops to ask for directions, they found the neighborhood they were looking for, the aptly named Soweto. Given the conditions here, Jack imagined most of its occupants would prefer living in its South African namesake. The road took them over a hill and down into a shallow valley whose slopes had been tiered into lots for huts. Soweto's business district was a 100-yard-long stretch of mom-and-pop businesses that offered food, repairs, and medicines. At René's direction, Jack pulled the Toyota to a stop beside a brick building painted bright red. The sign over an open garage bay said, Smarties Repairs. They got out and went into the cool of the garage. In German, René asked one of the mechanics something. The man pointed to an open door to their right. Inside, they found a pot-bellied, middle-aged man sitting at a desk. His head was shaved. He was rubbing lotion into his scalp. He raised a hand in greeting, then wiped his hands on his pants and walked up to the counter.
English? René asked. Some good, some not. Tell him what you want, Jack.
Just like that? Can we trust him? René chuckled. You think he is an undercover cop, so dedicated he chooses to live here year-round and run a business? No, this is Smarty, the owner, and the most honest arms dealer in Windhoek.
Who told you that?
Everyone.
No one, replied René.
Go ahead, tell him what you want. If he has it, he'll give you a price. There's no haggling. His prices are fair.
Jack had been assembling an equipment list in his mind. He shrugged. When in Rome. As Jack spoke each item, Smarty would say either yes or no. He had 80% of what Jack requested, including a trio of AK-47s and 1,000 rounds of ammunition. Smarty wrote a price on a strip of paper and slid it over to Jack, who said, That's fair. You take dollars?
Everything but Discover card, Smarty replied.
It was late afternoon by the time they put Windhoek in the Land Cruiser's rearview mirror and began the 2-hour journey up the Western Bypass. Assuming that at some point he would be returning to Coracepa Lodge, Jack spent some extra time studying the area's topology and road systems, if they could be called that. As he'd learned during his first reconnoiter, once off the Western Bypass, the roads were all dirt and often little wider than a vehicle. Still, looking at the Google Earth screenshots he'd stored on his phone, he counted at least 4 ways in and out of the Coracepa Lodge area. They were 20 miles south of Ozona airstrip when the sun began dipping behind the mountains to the west. René, whose window had borne the brunt of the afternoon sun, said, Thank God, and returned the visor to its overhead position. Jack's phone chirped.
What's the screen say, René?
It says tracking.
That's the GPS I planted on the Pilatus. The app icon is on the home screen, lower left corner. Call up the map. The tracker will show up as a pulsing blue dot.
Yes, I have it.
Tell me where it's going.
South.
South? That was wrong. Midgard's runway ran east to west. Let me see. Take the wheel.
Rene grabbed the wheel and Jack studied the phone's screen. The tracker was indeed moving south, away from the runway and onto the same road he'd taken into Coruscant Lodge. When the dot reached the fork in the road, it turned left toward the lodge itself. Clearly it wasn't the Pilatus taxiing down that narrow ravine road. Someone found the tracker and planted it on a vehicle.
Who?
It had to have been either Ephraim or Muller. Ephraim in an attempt to aid Jack's pursuit of Muller. Muller hoping to make it look that way and lure Jack into an ambush. Here was another classic damned if you do, damned if you don't scenario. Either Ephraim was aboard this vehicle, or he was still at the lodge.
Jack watched the dot until it came to a stop in what he estimated was the lodge's lobby turnaround.
Jack retook the Toyota's wheel and handed the phone back to Rene, who asked,
Well, what do we do?
Nothing's changed. We keep going.
They drove in silence for 5 minutes before Rene said,
It's moving again. Back's the way it came.
Now turning north towards Swakopmund Dam Reservoir.
It's heading for the western bypass.
Can we intercept them?
Jack checked his watch and did a quick calculation.
Maybe. It's going to be tight.
Jack pressed harder on the accelerator. The miles and minutes ticked by as Jack and Rene kept heading north and the blue dot west toward the western bypass. The sun's upper rim finally slipped behind the hills, and Jack turned on the Land Cruiser's headlights. Bugs began to strike the windshield with rapid, overlapping clicks. The sign for Ozona flashed past the windshield, followed soon after by the sign for Okahanja. 10 miles to the turnoff. Jack asked Rene, Where is it?
Rene turned the phone so Jack could see the screen.
Still heading west, closing towards a western bypass. He's got maybe 4 miles to go.
Too close. Too close, Jack murmured.
Rene said, We don't even know if he's in that vehicle, Jack.
I know that. If he isn't and we lose it, that tracker won't last forever. Beyond 50 miles, the signal will be too weak. If he's still at the lodge.
Rene finished his thought.
There's only one reason Muller would leave Ephraim behind.
Because Muller was finished with him. And if Ephraim was aboard that vehicle, it was as a captive, in which case he was still alive, but on borrowed time. Lose, lose. Jack stomped on the accelerator. The Toyota's speedometer swept past 146 kph. The headlights picked out a sign ahead. Okahanja, 3 kilometers.
The turnoff to the lodge is well before that, Rene said. It'll come up fast. You might want to start slowing.
Jack kept his foot on the accelerator.
Get the AKs from the back seat and prep them.
Their best opportunity to ambush the vehicle was before it traded the narrow dirt road for the broad blacktop.
Another sign. D2102, 500 meters.
Jack let his foot off the accelerator.
Rene had his face pressed to his window, hand cupped around his eyes.
I see them. Headlights. They're very close, Jack.
Jack doused the Land Cruiser's headlights. I'm going to have to turn hard right, so hang on. As soon as I come to a stop, open fire on the vehicle's engine block. Get it stopped, but keep your shots low. I'll go for the occupants.
Jack, hit the brakes.
What? Why?
I count 3 pairs of headlights. No, 4. It's a convoy. We can't handle 4 at the same time, Jack. You know that. Get us out of sight.
Damn it. Jack stepped on the brakes. The Land Cruiser started fishtailing. Jack eased right and the tires bumped onto the shoulder.
Ahead, the lead vehicle was coming to a stop, its right blinker flashing in the darkness. It was a Toyota Hilux, Jack saw. He braked again, jerked the wheel harder right, and pointed the hood toward the drainage ditch. The front tires thumped over a berm, and the nose vaulted upward, then dropped again. Jack braked, and the Land Cruiser ground to a halt beside a boulder. Jack climbed out, and using the boulder as cover, maneuvered until he could see the turnoff. The fourth and final vehicle in the convoy turned onto the highway and sped north into the night.
Chapter 36, Western Bypass, Namibia.
"You have to decide, Jack," Rene called from the Land Cruiser. "What's it going to be?"
Jack turned and sprinted back to the Land Cruiser.
"The lodge."
He backed out of the ditch onto the road, then pulled ahead and turned onto the dirt road. Jack covered the 10 miles to the airstrip lodge fork in 20 minutes. Headlights off again, he turned left until he saw the edge of the runway. The Pilatus was still there, wheels chocked and windows dark. Wherever that convoy was headed, it was either too close to justify the flight or located too far from a landing site. Jack turned around, made his way back to the fork, and turned toward the lodge. When he reached the cobblestone entrance, Jack said, "Rostock rented out the entire lodge. There's no staff. Anyone with a gun is fair game."
"I understand," said Rene.
"We'll check the bungalows first."
"I'll follow your lead."
Jack braked to a stop 10 feet before the arch and shut off the engine. Rene handed him one of the AKs and a pair of magazines. Jack inserted one of them into the AK, cycled the bolt, then made sure the safety was on. They climbed out of the SUV. With Jack in the lead, they headed through the arch. He pointed right toward the lobby doors. Rene nodded and checked the doors. He shook his head. They continued on. When they reached the lawn, Jack pointed across to the line of 8 bungalows, then gestured to Rene and mouthed, "Spread right." 20 feet apart and walking abreast, they crossed the lawn. No lights were visible in the bungalows. Jack angled toward the one on the far left. Rene adjusted course to match him, his AK raised and tracking back and forth. When Jack reached the first bungalow's walkway, Rene stacked up behind him and gave him an "I'm here" pat on the shoulder, and together they approached the door, then split, one on either side of the door. Jack crouched, leaned sideways, and peeked through the window. The interior was tidy, with no signs of occupancy. He looked at Rene and shook his head. They retraced their steps to the sidewalk and moved on to the next bungalow. Here, too, Jack saw nothing to indicate it had been used recently. At the 3rd and 4th bungalows, same result. As they approached the 5th bungalow's walkway, Jack caught a whiff of something in the air. It was the acrid stench of overseared meat. He glanced at Rene, who tapped his nose, pointed at the bungalow's front door, and mouthed, "Coming from in there." Jack stopped at the door. His check through the window revealed the bungalow's interior was in disarray. The beds were unmade, and food trays were stacked on the dresser. Beer bottles overflowed the garbage can. In the center of the room was a hardback chair. Dangling from both of its legs was what looked like duct tape. Jack signaled to Rene, "Going in," and got a nod in return. Jack tried the knob. The door was unlocked. They went through and quickly cleared the bungalow. Jack and Rene clicked on their flashlights and looked around. On the floor beside the chair was a blood-stained white towel, and balanced on the closest corner of the dresser was a curling iron. Its chrome surface was splotched with a dark, flaky material.
"It's charred skin," Rene whispered. "Fresh."
"Oh, Christ," Jack thought.
"Let's keep moving."
At the sidewalk, they turned left and headed to the next bungalow. Jack froze. Rene followed suit.
Noise. What was it?
A muffled clang, a scraping sound. It was familiar. It took Jack a few more seconds to pigeonhole the noise. A shovel in dirt.
A male voice shouted, "Beeile dich!"
"Hurry up." "It's coming from behind the bungalows," Rene whispered.
Jack started running. At the last bungalow, the sidewalk turned left. Jack followed it down a tree-lined path to an oval-shaped dirt parking lot, fronted by a split-rail fence. When Jack reached its edge, he stopped and dropped into a crouch. The lot's far edge was made up of overgrown bushes. There was a vehicle in the lot, a black Hilux. Through the bushes came a flicker of light. Jack looked at Rene, who nodded his readiness. They stepped over the fence, crossed the parking lot and split up, each taking one side of the Hilux. They met at the front bumper.
I'm done,
a man called. It was ragged and weak, but Jack recognized the voice. Ephraim.
If you're going to do it, just do it. Assholes.
In German-accented English, a voice replied, Suit yourself. Rolf, get the gas can. The bushes rustled. Rolf stepped into view. Dangling from his right hand was a semi-auto pistol.
René, take him, Jack ordered.
René lifted his AK and put three rounds into the man's chest. Even as the man fell, Jack sprinted past him and crashed into the bushes. He burst into a small clearing lit by an LED lantern sitting on the ground. The other German stood at the head of a pit. Ephraim was in it, stripped to the waist and slick with blood and dirt and sweat. Jack shot the German in the side, and he stumbled and dropped to his knees. Jack shot him in the side of the head. He toppled over. Jack called to Ephraim, Anyone else?
No, just the two of them.
Ephraim lifted the shovel above his head and hurled it at the German's body. He turned to Jack.
Jack, will you please get me out of here?
They put Ephraim in the Hilux, then drove it around the fence and onto the lawn, stopping before the last bungalow. After shouldering the door open, René stood watch while Jack helped Ephraim inside and sat him on a bed. René called, I'll have a look around for other stragglers and then get the first aid kit. As he left, he shut the door behind him. Jack closed the curtains and turned on the bungalow's overhead lights. Ephraim's appearance momentarily paralyzed Jack. Scattered across Ephraim's torso were at least 10 cylindrical burn marks from the curling iron. The tips of his pinky and third finger on his left hand were pulp, probably the work of a hammer, Jack guessed. Ephraim's bottom lip was split, and his right eye socket was so badly bruised and swollen, it looked like a smashed plum.
Fucking hell, Jack muttered. Is it bad?
Ephraim said.
Pretty bad. It's starting to hurt, Jack. Really bad. For a while I was numb. But now it's...
Ephraim winced, then exhaled heavily. He cradled his shattered hand in his lap.
He didn't ask me anything. Not one question.
Müller?
He just did it. For no reason. For fun.
Ephraim's eyes brimmed with tears.
Müller told those two to get rid of me. I thought, well, how much can a bullet to the head hurt? And then they told me to start digging. They were going to set me on fire, bury me in that hole. Why? Why that way?
Because Müller's a psychopath, Jack thought, but didn't say. Ephraim was crying now, his chest heaving with sobs. Jack sat down on the bed and pulled Ephraim's head onto his shoulder. You're alive, Ephraim. Just keep repeating that in your head. I'm alive. René returned with the first aid kit and went to work on Ephraim, checking him for any obvious signs of brain damage or internal hemorrhaging, then having him down 4 ibuprofen, followed by 2 miniature bottles of whiskey Jack found in the dresser. Once the battered journalist had stopped shaking, René turned his attention to Ephraim's burns and wounds. He left Ephraim's hand for last.
Hammer?
René asked him. Plumber's wrench, Ephraim replied. Jack asked, What's the diagnosis?
The burns are superficial. As long as they're kept clean, they'll heal. Same with his eye and lip. What about my hand?
Asked Ephraim.
I'm going to lose those fingers, aren't I?
Only if they get infected. The tips of the bones are broken, but the blood flow is still there. You will unfortunately never attain your dream of being a hand model. Ephraim smiled faintly.
Guess I'll have to stick with journalism.
Jack.
I'm sorry. You said jump, and I didn't jump. I was worried we were going to lose Müller. I had a gut feeling that Pilatus wasn't going to move, but Müller was. I thought if I could at least follow them for a while, we'd have a direction to follow.
You moved the GPS tracker? Ephraim nodded, and Jack said, You're forgiven. They covered him in blankets and gave him another mini bottle of whiskey. He was asleep within minutes.
He's fighting shock, Rene said. He needs at least 4 hours of sleep before we move him. We need to get him back to Windhoek.
Good luck with that. He's stubborn.
And you're okay with him coming with us?
Jack said, not really. But he's earned the right to decide for himself. Even if he just wants to go along for the ride, I'm going to let him. Rene shrugged.
You're the leader. These are some terrible men we're dealing with, Jack. What they did to him, what they were going to do to him.
I know. And they belong to Rostock. This wasn't a question, Jack realized, but rather a statement. The only emotion he heard in Renee's voice was one of cold resignation. He'd cleared the chasm, Jack knew. 75 minutes after they arrived at the lodge, the GPS tracker's signal faded with the convoy still heading north on the western bypass. Jack told Rene, "We lost them."
"Maybe not," Ephraim said from the other bed. He reached out and turned on the nightstand lamp. "I heard Muller say something about GPS und the Hilux. Maybe its nav system was programmed so they could catch up to the main group."
Rene was already on his feet. "I'll check." He returned to the bungalow a few minutes later.
"He's right. There's a destination programmed into the system."
"Where?"
"Someplace called Kavango Dam."
Chapter 37. Korosepa Lodge, Namibia. Rene monitored Ephraim's condition through the night, and shortly after dawn proclaimed him fit to travel. To assuage his conscience, Jack tried to convince Ephraim to take the Hilux back to treatment idea even before all the words had left Jack's mouth. After stripping the two dead Germans and their Hilux of anything of use, Jack and the others piled back into the Land Cruiser, left the lodge, and made their way back to the Western Bypass. According to the coordinates in the Hilux's navigation system, Kavango Dam lay 110 miles to the northeast, but neither Jack's phone map nor Renee's paper map showed any sign of the structure, or of any body of water. Worse still, though the dam lay just 30 miles west of the Western Bypass, the only access road snaked its way through 150 miles of Otjo-Zanjipa region's most rugged terrain. By mid-morning, having traveled as far north as possible on the Western Bypass, Jack turned off the blacktop and headed east on a dirt track that was little more than twin wheel ruts worn into the earth. After 4 hours, they'd covered only 80 miles, and the road was worsening as it zigzagged deeper into the hills. By nightfall, they were still 40 miles from their destination. The road narrowed until the view out Jack's window was blocked by a sheer rock face. From the back seat, Ephraim said, "The other side's even worse, Jack. About 3 feet from our tires, there's a drop-off. I can't even see the bottom." Rene asked Jack, "Push on, or stop and set up camp for the night?"
"Push on," Jack replied. "Muller has a good 8-hour head start on us. For all we know, they're already at Kavango."
"Yes, but doing what?" asked Rene.
"Ephraim, check your phone," Jack said. Since they'd left Korosepa Lodge, their reception had been wildly sporadic. Any headway Ephraim made into researching Kavango Dam was maddeningly short-lived. Despite the pain, he had been working hard to assemble these information snippets into something cohesive. So far, all they knew was that the Kavango Dam had been completed just 2 months earlier at a half-mile-wide section of the Omotako River. Since then, a massive reservoir had been building behind the dam. Downstream from the dam were nearly 20 villages and farms.
Ephraim said, "I've got a bit of signal. Let me see what I can do with it."
After another 90 minutes and 10 miles, the road widened and began descending. Jack was able to pick up some speed. By midnight, they were within 8 miles of the dam.
"It turns out Kavango's a regulator dam," Ephraim said from the darkness of the back seat.
"Which is what?" asked Jack.
"Regulator dams are built upstream from hydroelectric dams. They're designed to control the volume of water flowing into a hydro."
"Is there a hydro around here?"
asked Rene. Not yet. Evidently, Kavango's a sort of trial balloon for something called the Ochozanjipa Renewal Project. By 2028, the Namibian government wants to be exporting electricity to its neighbors. If Kavango works, they're planning to build a hydro a mile downstream. Rene said, What's that mean, works? Either it holds back the water or not, yes? No. Apparently, regulator dams require some pretty sophisticated hydraulic control systems. They're due for a proof-of-concept test in 2 days. Ephraim's words struck a chord in Jack's brain. Systems, he repeated. As in computer-controlled systems? Ephraim was silent for a few seconds. Shit. That's it. What? Rene said. I don't understand. Ephraim, who installed the Kavango control systems? A British company called Mondrian Engineering. Was it an open bid process? I don't know for sure. Probably so. That was the connection, Jack realized. Rostock had been hired by one of Mondrian's competitors to sabotage Kavango's flow control systems. Jack explained it to Rene, who asked, Ephraim, how many people live downstream from Kavango? Hundreds? Maybe 1,000? Jack steered the Land Cruiser over a rise and stopped. He shut off the headlights. Below them, running from east to west, was a curved line of pole-mounted sodium vapor lights. Beneath these, Jack could make out the dam's faded, ochre-colored concrete parapet. Rising from its midpoint was a bunker-like structure that Jack assumed led to the dam's interior. Jack got out his binoculars and scanned the length of the parapet. At the far end, barely visible in the shadows, was a trio of black pickup trucks. Jack handed the binoculars to Rene, who looked and then nodded. Müller's Hilux. Yes, that's them. I don't see anyone about. You think they're already inside? Asked Ephraim. I'd put money on it. Klugman has to work his voodoo from the control room or else he wouldn't be in Namibia. Jack put the Toyota in neutral, took his foot off the brake, and let gravity carry them down the hillside to the dam's access road. When they were 50 yards from the parapet, he braked to a stop. Rene said, I wish we had more time to plan this, Jack. If wishes were horses, we'd have an Apache providing air cover for us. Ephraim, get out and come around to my side. You're driving. What? You're going to find some high ground and start video recording. What good will that do? Maybe none, but you're doing it. If Rene and I don't come back out, you need to get to Windhoek and contact Mitch. He's got an email address you're going to need. Tell the person on the other end the whole story, and they'll take it from there. Jack felt a vibration rising through the Land Cruiser's floorboards. What is that? Asked Rene. Down the length of the dam, red strobe lights began flashing. A pair of men emerged from the parapet's access bunker and began jogging toward the Hiluxes at the far end. Time's up, Jack said. Chapter 38. Kavango Dam, Namibia. With Jack in the lead, they sprinted onto the parapet. Keep an eye out for Klugman, Jack called to Rene. How will I know it's him? Whoever hasn't got a gun doesn't get shot. Right. Jack glanced over his shoulder. Ephraim was standing near his open driver's door. Jack stopped, turned back. Get moving, damn it! He shouted. He waited until Ephraim climbed into the Toyota and started backing down the access road before he started running again. Rene was 50 yards ahead. Two more men emerged from the control bunker's door. Neither one was Müller, but Jack had no way of knowing whether one of them was Gerhard Klugman. Both were carrying FAMAS assault rifles. Rene opened fire. One of the men went down. His partner ducked back through the bunker's door and swung it shut behind him. Rene peppered the door with his AK. The rounds sparked on the steel. Jack caught up with Rene and jogged the remaining distance to the door. It suddenly opened, and a FAMAS barrel emerged. Jack dodged right and Rene dropped flat. Jack dropped to one knee and sprayed the door's gap. The FAMAS disappeared back through the door, which swung open to reveal a body lying across a steel catwalk landing. Jack sprinted toward the door. He called, "Renee, you good?" He got no answer. He glanced over his shoulder. Renee was lying face down on the concrete. He wasn't moving. A pool of blood spread beneath his body. "I'm sorry, Renee," Jack thought, and kept running. At the door, he pressed himself against the bunker wall, took a breath, then peeked through the door in time to see two men rushing up the steps. Jack shot the first one twice in the chest, then dropped to one knee and stitched the second man's legs out from under him. The man tumbled back down the steps. Jack followed him. The man was stunned as much by the fall as by the damage to his legs. He had lost his rifle, but Jack frisked him anyway. Once he was sure the semi-conscious man posed no further threat, Jack turned down the next set of steps to a concrete alcove. To his left and right were two royal blue steel doors. Jack flipped a mental coin and opened the door on the left, revealing a maintenance tunnel no wider than his shoulders and dimly lit by overhead fluorescent bulbs. Electrical conduits lined the concrete wall. The hum of machinery was thunderous and rhythmic. Jack could feel it in his belly. He shut the door and tried the other one, which opened onto a catwalk lit by pendant lights. Jack stepped to the handrail and looked down. He saw nothing but blackness and billowing mist. He could hear the roar of gushing water. The air smelled of ozone. To his right, the catwalk ended, so Jack turned left and jogged 50 feet until he reached a set of steps that took him down to another catwalk. At its far end, a set of short steps led to a glass control booth. Through the windows, Jack could see flashing red and orange lights. He started down the catwalk. In the control booth, two figures rose up and began shattering the glass windows with the butts of their rifles. Moving at a sprint, Jack opened fire on the booth. The two men ducked out of sight. Jack reached the steps. He crouched so his head was below the door's lower edge, then ejected the AK's magazine and inserted another. He then reached forward, tapping the AK's barrel against the door. A horizontal line of bullet holes appeared in the steel. Jack rolled back on his heels, then onto his back, and took aim on the control booth. "Wait, Jack. Wait." A figure appeared in the window. Jack pulled the trigger. The man's head disappeared in a halo of red mist. There was at least one more man on the other side of this door, and unless Jack was willing to backtrack and look for another way into the control booth, his only option was to suck it up and go. He stood up and pressed himself as tightly against the handrail as possible, then mounted the steps and grabbed the doorknob. Stop. He needed a little misdirection. He pointed the AK up at the control booth window, fired a short burst, then swung open the door and charged through. He found himself in a short passageway of white-painted cinder blocks. At the end was an open door. He headed for it. Halfway there, a figure dashed past the opening from right to left. Jack almost opened fire, but caught himself. The man hadn't been armed. Klugman, maybe? At the door, Jack peeked left, saw a set of steel steps that led to what he guessed was the control room. To his right was a yellow door with black lettering that read Maintenance Ladder. Jack stepped left, crept up the steps to the control room door, where he paused. Don't stop. Don't think, he told himself. Giving himself a chance to weigh the odds and rethink tactics would consume time he didn't have. He swung himself through the door. The room was empty. The wall to the left of the windows was dominated by a long control console, its buttons and built-in screens a sea of flashing warning lights. Too late, Jack thought. Whatever was happening was beyond his abilities to control. Clearly, the dam's flow control systems had already fallen prey to Klugman's virus. Hundreds of thousands of gallons of water were already gushing down the Omotako River toward the farms and villages downstream. If he couldn't stop it, he needed to at least be able to prove who started it. Jack left. As he turned onto the stairs, he saw a rifle butt plunging toward his face. He jerked his head to the side and the butt slammed into his cheekbone, then slid down the side of his head and clipped his ear. He heard rather than felt the tearing of cartilage. Blood gushed down his neck. He stumbled sideways.
His AK fell through the railing and crashed to the floor below. Blind in his right eye, Jack reached up, bear-hugged the figure standing there, then pushed off, sending them both down the stairs with the man's rifle sandwiched between them. As they fell, Jack caught a glimpse of the yellow maintenance door swinging shut. Still entwined, he and his attacker smashed into the floor with Jack on top. He raised himself, gaining some maneuvering room, and slashed the point of his elbow across the man's nose, breaking it, then into the side of his neck, and continued punching until the man went still. His face was a mask of blood. Jack got up, grabbed his AK, and headed toward the yellow door. On the other side was a ladder leading up to a fluorescent-lighted opening. He was at the opposite end of the tunnel he'd found on his way in. At the top of the ladder, he crawled into the tunnel. He stood up and started running. Ahead of him, two figures disappeared around a curve in the tunnel. Jack was there a few seconds later, just as the second man stepped left through a door. He was unarmed. Jack lifted the AK, took aim, fired. The bullet punched into the back of the man's right thigh. He collapsed through the door and out of sight. Jack sprinted ahead and peeked around the corner. A stocky, bald man with a pasty face lay on his back, both hands clutched around his bleeding hamstring. The man was wearing a black t-shirt. Emblazoned across the chest in red German Fraktur-style letters were the words, "Game of Thrones, winter is coming." "Gerhard Klugman," Jack said. "I've been looking for you." Half-dragging, half-carrying Klugman, Jack hurried up the steps to the parapet. Renee's body was gone. "Over here," Jack heard. He turned to see Renee sitting with his back against the bunker. His left arm was bloody and bent backward at the elbow. Jack dumped Klugman onto the parapet and asked Renee, "Muller?" "That way, toward the hilux." Jack walked to the center of the parapet. Stefan Muller, still bearing the limp from Jack's bullet at the Alexandria Nature Preserve, had only gotten 100 yards toward the hilux. "Muller, stop!" Jack shouted. Muller kept going. Jack lifted the AK to his shoulder and fired. The bullet smacked into the concrete to the left of Muller's feet. The German glanced over his shoulder, shouted something at Jack, and then tried to pick up the pace, his limp now a penguin-like hobble. "Last chance!" Jack yelled. Rene said, "Just kill him already. We can use him. He can hand us Rostock." Jack laid the AK's front post over Muller's legs and fired a short burst. Muller went down. He writhed, then rolled onto his belly. Jack started walking down the parapet toward him. He'd covered half the distance when he heard the roar of an engine. A horn began blaring. Jack turned, raised the AK. He lowered it. With Ephraim behind the wheel, the Toyota Land Cruiser swerved around Jack, straightened out, and sped toward Muller, who'd managed to get to his knees. "Ephraim!" Jack shouted. "Don't! We need him!" The Toyota eased left as Ephraim aimed the hood at Muller, then began picking up speed. Muller, apparently hearing the approaching engine, looked over his shoulder. Ephraim never hit the brakes. Epilogue, Paris, France. True to his word, the same day Jack appeared at the front Gaston's estate with René in tow, his arm in a wrist-to-shoulder cast, the marshal opened his black leather-bound address book and started making phone calls. Though Ephraim, now back in Brussels and working with Mitch via phone, was still weeks away from fully assembling what Jack suspected would be more than enough evidence to prompt a German and EU investigation into Rostock's security group, René Allemand's account of his ordeal at the hands of Rostock had been more than enough to spur his father into action. Despite the marshals having both retired from the military and withdrawn from the social limelight, his clout was significant. By mid-afternoon, the first reports of anonymous allegations against Rostock Security Group and its founder were surfacing on European news networks and radio stations. The beating of the drum had begun. Marshal Allemand would soon be calling a press conference.
He assured Jack he would not be the only person of influence standing before the microphones. Apparently, Rostock had visited his hardball tactics on other VIPs across Europe. From Italy to Great Britain, Marshal Almond had little trouble convincing his peers of what Rostock had been up to. Those who had balked at supporting the Germans' endeavors but had failed to speak out were now only too happy to join the growing coalition. And before Almond was done, Jack guessed, those who had covertly supported Rostock would have to choose between coming forward of their own volition and being exposed by the looming investigation. Jack had gladly accepted Marshal Almond's invitation to stay at the estate for as long as he wished. With a deadline looming, he needed the time to think, but not about his decision, which he'd made even before they left Namibia. Playing shepherd to the impulsive Ephraim and erratic René had been a brutal, eye-opening crash course in personnel management. Jack knew where he belonged. While the choice was an easy one, the road he'd taken to it had been painful and costly. Jürgen Rostock would fall, of that Jack was certain. Taken alone, that was a victory that would save lives in the future. But it had also taken lives beyond those of Peter Hahn and Caitlin Showalter. 322, to be exact. Jack's failure to stop Müller from sabotaging Kavango Dam's flow control system had cost the lives of 322 men, women, and children who'd been unable to escape the deluge before it engulfed their villages and farms. Inevitably and predictably, he found himself replaying the same question in his mind. If he'd been quicker or smarter, could he have stopped it? There was no answer, he knew. But he also knew it would be a long time before he stopped asking the question. As he had for most of the past several days, today Jack slept until mid-morning, then jogged around the estate and swam laps in the pool before playing a game of tennis with Claude. When he came back into the house, Jack found René and Hugo seated across from each other in the solarium. Smiling, the marshal waved Jack over to the table and poured him coffee. Jack asked René, "When did you last talk to Ephraim?"
"Not for a few days. I've left messages, but he hasn't responded. I hope that simply means he's busy digging Rostock's grave, and it's not the other thing."
"Other thing?" said the marshal.
"Müller," Jack replied.
Back on the dam's parapet, Jack had been expecting Ephraim to swerve or break at the last moment, but he'd done neither. Müller had died instantly, just as Eric Schrader had outside the Supermercado in Alexandria. For reasons he hadn't quite fathomed, Jack was finding it hard to enjoy the irony behind the two men's deaths. Jack suspected that whatever satisfaction Ephraim had gotten from killing Stefan Müller had been fleeting and bittersweet. While Müller had tortured Ephraim and ordered him burned alive in a hole in the ground, Jack believed Ephraim was strong enough to get past that. But could he get past what he himself had done in retaliation? On the positive side, whatever moral struggles Ephraim might be facing, he wasn't doing it alone. At Marie Lickel's urging, Ephraim had moved back home to the Lickel estate, where he and Belinda Hahn were, according to Marie, getting to know one another. Jack was glad for them both. René, too, had a long, tough road ahead of him. Coming to grips with the damage done to him by Rostock may have already cost René his relationship with Madeleine. The wedding was on hold, as was René's future with the army. Everything seemed tainted, he'd told Jack. "Where do things stand with Alexander Bossard?" Jack asked. Hugo Almond answered.
"One of my attorneys is in Zurich, deposing him as we speak. Whatever you said to him, Jack, was more than enough to secure his cooperation. Once we have his deposition, we will make sure it reaches the proper authorities. It will be more than enough to tip the first domino. Jürgen Rostock, I suspect, is about to face a dramatic reversal of fortune."
Jack had little trouble believing this. Like Bossard, Gerhard Klugman, now recovering from his gunshot wound and certain Rostock was hunting for him, had been debriefed by Marshal Allemand's legal team. The hacker was savvy enough to have realized that his former employer was no longer the winning team, and that the best way to stay out of both Rostock's crosshairs and prison was to cooperate. According to Allemand's lawyer, Klugman was a disturbingly immaculate record keeper. Jack checked his watch. It was 3 o'clock, 9 a.m. back home. "Will you excuse me?" Jack said, and stood up. He walked out the solarium's side door and onto the lawn. He sat down in the grass. He pulled out his phone and hit the speed dial. The line clicked open, and the voice at the other end said, "Jerry Hendley." "Jerry, it's Jack. I think it's time we talk." This is Scott Brick. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Tom Clancy, Duty and Honor, by Grant Blackwood. This program was directed by Chris Kaczewski, executive producer Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2016 by The Estate of Thomas L. Clancy, Jr., Rubicon Incorporated, Jack Ryan Enterprises Limited, and Jack Ryan Limited Partnership. Production copyright 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.